Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. If you're a business owner and you want to increase your cash flow, or if you're a label or artist and you want to promote new music, then listen up. For information about advertising on Everyone Loves Guitar, including information on geographically targeted ads, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. The Be Fulfilled Journal helps you be more honest with yourself and with others and be more open to handling things you've avoided dealing with for years. It's a 12-week online and journal program that helps you identify and eliminate things you do that are causing you stress and live in more gratitude and joy. It was actually developed by a long-term friend of mine who got sober in 2008, and he's put together a great deal just for my listeners. You get the 300-page hardcover journal and access to the 12-week video program online, plus free shipping, plus membership in a private Facebook support group with others going through the program, plus a 5-day mini course showing you how to let go of stuff that's draining your energy, plus a 30-day 100% money-back guarantee. To start your journey and get all the bonuses, go to befulfilledjournal.com/ELG. That's befulfilledjournal.com/ELG. Hey, this is Craig. Hope you enjoyed our greatest hits over the last 10 days. And today is going to be our final episode of that with Randy Jackson. Monday, we start fresh. Eugene Edwards, Dwight Yoakam's guitarist, great guy. He's got some good stories. And on Tuesday, we start broadcasting on YouTube, so you can see the actual audios or videos of the conversations and the interviews being recorded there. Just do me a favor. It'll be the last time I ask you to do this. I know I've asked a lot. Thank you for your patience. Go to YouTube, enter Everyone Loves Guitar, go subscribe to our channel. Really appreciate that. And click on the bell next to it, just to the right. So here's the deal with Randy Jackson. Randy Jackson is a guy who is a tremendous guitar player, but he ran a band called Zebra. He was the primary songwriter and lead singer and guitarist of the band Zebra. Zebra was a Long Island band. Nobody knew this. I didn't know this back then. They were from Louisiana, New Orleans, actually. And he talks about why he moved up to Long Island, but they were huge up there. And I think they had the largest opening album in the first week because of the following in New York. And he talks about the story why and the buildup that led to it. But what's funny about this for me is Randy was the first interview I had. I was not nervous and not starstruck, but I was so excited. I was like a little kid because I had listened to Zebra's first album, man, like just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. And I knew all the songs on that record, man, like cold. And that record just meant a lot to me. It was a time in my life where probably things were not going really well for me, but that music always kept me afloat. And so it was a real special thing for me to talk with Randy. The thing that's most amazing about his story, above maybe all the other interviews I've had, is we talked about serendipity and how something unlikely happens. The way these guys got signed was so unlikely. It was almost like it was a miracle, man. I mean, he tells the story and it was just mind-blowing. The unlikely series of events that happened, and the guy had just said, listened to the cassette and said, fuck it, I'm not signing these guys. They don't have the right music, because there's this really long song, Take Your Fingers From My Hair, great song, but it opens acoustically, and he wanted to sign some rockin' band, but just like some Zeppelin songs open acoustically and they rock, this was in the same vein. But the unlikely event that happened for him to, not 30 seconds later, say, oh my God, I got to get these guys, it just blew me away. I couldn't believe it. So this story is truly you know, people often say, what's your favorite episode? I don't really have a favorite episode, but this is my favorite serendipity story because it's almost unreal, you know. He also has some real cool stories about playing with Yorma Kalkin in the Jefferson Airplane, hanging out with Paul Kantner and Paul smoking a joint while they were playing, and talks about some stuff that really kind of messed him up and getting sober and all that stuff. Really interesting, very interesting call. I found it really just very captivating, and I think you'll like it too. Very compelling stories throughout the whole interview. So enjoy it. It's Randy Jackson. If you're not familiar with Zebra, check out Old Zebra. They band still tours, and they are, I don't know where they're playing now, but you can go to Randy's website for sure, and maybe there's a Zebra website as well. But check out that first album, and check out the song Take Your Fingers From My Hair from Zebra. There's a couple of other big major hits on there, and he talks about them on the interview. So enjoy it. Thank you for listening. I can't wait to see you Monday with all the new shows and the new guests we have. We've got some terrific guests coming up that I'm really excited about, and just some really cool stuff going on. As always, thank you. I couldn't do this without you, and the show couldn't exist, and I couldn't go on doing it without your support. So thank you very much for listening. Have a great weekend. Enjoy Randy Jackson's show. Hi, this is Craig. Just want to let you know you can now advertise here on Everyone Loves Guitar podcast. For more information, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and we have one of my actual guitar heroes and band leaders and guy who I listen to his records literally maybe 500 times. We're with Randy Jackson, the guitarist and founder of Zebra. In 1975, Randy, along with bassist Felix Hanneman and drummer Guy Gelso, formed Zebra down in New Orleans, actually, which is something I never knew. And after playing New Orleans for 2 years, they moved up to Long Island in New York in 77. And at the time, they dedicated themselves to playing that area's club and college scene, which there were tons of clubs there, mainly as a cover band, interestingly enough. They were talented enough, though, that Atlantic signed them to a 5-album deal right out of the gate in late 1982. So note, words you will never hear in 2018. They got signed to a 5-album deal right out of the gate. First album, Zebra, went gold. It was the fastest selling debut album in the history of Atlanta Records. They sold 75,000 copies in its first week and spent 8 months on the Billboard charts, peaking at number 29. And I'll tell you, everybody was listening to this record. Any party you went to, it was on all night long. During the next couple of years, Zebra opened for Aerosmith, Journey, ZZ Top, Loverboy, Cheap Trick, Sammy Hagar, and REO Speedwagon. And during this period of time, like I said, Zebra was literally the hottest hard rock band throughout the tri-state area in Long Island. They later had groups like Dream Theater, Queensryche, and Bryan Adams opening for them. The band produced 4 studio and 2 live albums with combined sales of over 2 million, and they had 2 songs in the top 15. In addition to working with Zebra, Randy performs lead vocals for the music of Led Zeppelin, the music of Pink Floyd, and the music of the Doors tribute bands, along with live acoustic shows across the country. He's got one of the best falsetto voices you'll ever hear. In 1989, Randy got a call from drummer Kenny Aronoff to join him and to tour playing guitar and keyboards with the original Jefferson Airplane, as, you know, of course, Gray Slick, Marty Balin, Paul Kantner, Yorma, and Jack Cassidy on their U.S. reunion tour. And in 2010, Randy was inducted into the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame. And in 2012, Zebra was inducted into the Long Island Music Hall of Fame. Randy, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate you coming on the show, man.
Oh, thanks for having me, Craig.
You know, it's so funny.
You hear me?
Yeah, man, I hear you good. It's funny. I always have this expression, you can't connect the dots moving forward, you know? So if I'm sitting there, you know, maybe smoking a joint, listening to Zebra in college.
Right.
We'll be on the phone interview in 40 years. You know, it's so weird, yeah, stuff like that.
You never know where you're going to end up.
Right? Yeah, man, never. So I think, you know, I kind of alluded to this. I think everybody up north sort of just assumed you guys were from Long Island. Like, none of us knew you were originally from Louisiana. And I was curious, what prompted you guys to leave New Orleans and come up to the island in particular?
Well, we started off in New Orleans in 1975, and we had been playing down there for 2 years, and we were doing really well. had a lot of big following in New Orleans, and there were other bands in the area, older bands that we had seen that had kind of done the same thing, but didn't leave. And they were like heading down, you know, I mean, they had already had a good run, and we wanted to get a record deal. That was our goal. And we just kind of figured, well, the record companies aren't coming to New Orleans to find a rock band, so we better to go to where they are. And, so we were either going to go to Los Angeles or New York. And we happened to have a friend of ours in New York who knew a club owner and made the a hookup there. And eventually we got a couple of gigs for New Year's Eve of 1977 and came to New York and started performing in Long Island.
Wow. So you came there because you had a gig lined up, basically. Was it
Well, we needed to get out of there. We wanted to not overexpose ourselves in New Orleans. I mean, we were packing the biggest rock clubs that there were in New Orleans, and there really wasn't anywhere else for us to go. We were playing mainly cover tunes at the time, a lot of Aerosmith and Zeppelin, but we were playing a lot of originals. We had originals, so we were ready to go. You know, we had started playing them when we first went out. I think we had like 8 originals when we first started performing. And so the whole idea was to try to get a record deal. And we just didn't feel like we were going to get it in New Orleans. So.
Well, it worked, man. And I give you guys credit. That's a ballsy thing to do. But, you know, I think when you're younger, you're not looking at it like that. You just, you know, you want something, you go after it, right?
Yeah. I mean, we flew a guy down from New York to come see us, the guy that owned the club. I mean, it's a long story. He said he wanted us to come up during the summer and then called us right on the day we were getting ready to leave to New York. If you wait, because I don't have that many gigs for you. And we were all ready to go, and we had done our big, farewell show in New Orleans, you know, Zebra's going to New York, you know.
Oh,
and,
my God.
And so now we're like having to go back and say, well, we're not going to do it. And so we had another big farewell show like 5 months later, you know, the exact same thing happens.
No.
He says, I've only got one gig for you guys. I've only got one gig. I can't promise you any more than that, you know. And so we were like, I hung up with him, and then we sat around. We said, look, we can either do one or two things. We can, you know, we can hide. We cross the lake and stay. We went to New York and reappeared a couple of months. Or we could just go, you know, and just do the gig. So that's what we decided to do. We said, we're coming up there, one gig, and that's it. And that's what we did. We just headed up there. We had bought a new PA system in Tennessee. And, of course, that wasn't ready when we got there. So this guy was scrambling to get it ready. And then we headed up to New York, and we did our first gig on New Year's Eve, and it was with a band called Rat Race Choir. We did
sure, nights. I remember them.
Yeah, 2 nights with Rat Race Choir, and then you know we got some more gigs. You know, we played at a place called Chaucer's Ale House. We started getting some gigs at Hammerheads in Levittown, and a weekly gig there. I think it was on Thursdays, and things started clicking. So it worked out. You know, by the time. May came around. We went back in May. I think we stayed up for a couple of months through like March maybe, and then went back to New Orleans to make a little more money because we weren't making enough to survive up there. But we went back, and by the end of the summer, we were making enough money to where we could stay in New York if we wanted to. We didn't have to keep coming back to New Orleans to fill the till, you know?
Yeah. That's a cool story, man. I didn't know that. That's really good. Where were you living? Just be staying with somebody up there, or are you like renting a apartment?
Yeah, the guy, his name is Lee Feldman. He was the club owner, and Lee put us up in his attic. He had an attic. In Levittown. Yeah, so the attic was divided into two. It had like a divider straight down the middle, and so we had three of us would sleep on each side of the attic, and you know there wasn't enough room to stand up because it was just a We were like in two lean-tos is what it was.
Oh, my God.
So we're sleeping side by side like we're in some big sarcophagus, you know, together. And it was pretty funny, you know. But there were 6 of us, and we survived it, you know.
That's really cool. Fun. Yeah, what a great success story, man. and then you get a record deal for a 5-album record deal. Holy crap.
It's quite an experience, no doubt.
Were you surprised when you got the record deal? Okay, first of all, were you playing the songs, some of the originals, were you playing some of that material that ultimately wound up on the first record?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We had done a demo for some of the songs back in 1978, 79. And our manager at the time was a guy named Phil Basile, who had managed Vanilla Fudge. And he took the demos to Atlantic, and they weren't really interested. They said, this stuff sounds good, but it's dated. If you guys were out 10 years ago, you know, it would have been great. So they kind of said no to us at that point. This was like 1979, 78, right around then. And so, we got disappointed, and Phil was very involved in nightclubs all over Long Island, and I think he had kind of lost a little interest in it at that point. And so we just parted ways with him and headed down south, and we went out to California for a little while, and we met up with another guy who handled us for a couple of months, but he was having some personal issues. And then we made some demos, though, while we were out there, of some new songs. And in the meantime, the demos that we had originally made, you know, the ones that Atlantic had turned down, had been picked up by the radio station WBAB in Long Island.
Oh, yeah. Fingers Metal Shop, man. I used to listen to that every Sunday night, man. Like religion, it was. Yeah.
And Bob Buckman, who was the program director there, took a real liking to the band and started playing our stuff. They started it off on the Homegrown show, and then all of a sudden they put the songs into regular rotation because they were getting so many requests for them. And we knew we were getting played. I remember the first time I heard it, but you know, whether that was going to pan out into anything. But after we came back from California, I remember getting a call from my wife saying, you know, you got to call the record company wants to sign you and all this stuff. And I was like, wow, Atlantic Records, that's great. What happened? You know, well, as it turns out, Bob Buckman, the program director of the radio station, had met with a guy named Jason Flom. Jason was just starting off at Atlantic. He wasn't even an A&R guy at the time. He was just in promotion, trying to get a song played for Atlantic on WBAB. But when he went to meet with Bob, all Bob could talk to him about was this band who had the top 5 requested songs at the station. And so Jason was saying, well, that's great, top 5 local. He says, no. He says, top 5, and then Led Zeppelin In Through the Outdoor. And then Ace, you know, all these Back in Black. I mean, you know, because that's where it was. Nobody could buy the stuff. So, you know, they had to request it at the station. So we had an advantage there. But
oh, yeah. So that scarcity really helped you in a sense, like tremendously.
Big time. So so then Jason Flom goes back to Atlantic Records, and there's a new president there now, a guy named Doug Morris. Wasn't the same guy as was there when we our first – you know, when we had first approached him. And Doug took the tape, you know, and Doug was a friend of Jason's because Jason's father was a big wig on Warner's board. And so Jason had his ear, and he gave the tape to Doug that Bob had given him. I know I'm sounding confusing, but
no, anyway, it's actually making perfect sense. Actually.
Okay. President's got the demo tape, and the we found out years later that what actually happened was he took the demo tape and he got into a limo to go back to Long Island to his house, and he put the tape into the tape deck in the limo to listen to it. And the first song on the tape was Who's Behind the Door, and right, it's got the long acoustic intro.
Yeah.
So he's listening to it, and after about 25 seconds, he just ejects it.
You know, my God.
They want to get the beat of the song, but when he ejects it, the station, the radio just happens to be tuned into WBAB, and the song is playing. It's like, it just continues. It's like playing part of the song, and he's like, wait a minute. And he's pushing back in, and now he realizes it's on the radio. And so then he listens to the whole thing on the radio, and then the DJ says that's the most requested song at WBAB for the last 4 months, Zebra Who's Behind the Door. And that's how we got signed.
Holy what, like the statistical likelihood of that, every one of these events happening and lining up is like infinity, yeah. Man. Holy shit. Yeah. I got goosebumps when you said that. That is crazy, man.
Yeah. It was funny. So we got in there, you know, when I first met Doug, you know, although he wasn't there, I wasn't at Atlantic when we first came in, you know, he said, oh, this stuff is brilliant. It's so fresh. It's so new.
And, the other guy know. Said it was dated, the same material.
Exactly. I didn't say a word. I just said thank you.
It's funny though. He said it was dated because it really was very fresh and very new. And that was part of the appeal, you know, and you guys did a great job on all the instruments. You had the synths going, but it wasn't like the cheesy synths that was, you know, like had been around in that period. It was like really progressive rock. It was great, man. You know, that's so funny. Oh my God. That might be the best story I've heard out of everybody I've interviewed, man. That's almost impossible. Yeah. Holy shit. Wow. Sorry, man. I need a minute to process that. That is just crazy. I cannot believe it.
Well, we had pretty much given up on getting a record deal at that point. It was like 7 years at that point. And so my wife and I had bought a house in Louisiana. I was just kind of resigned to, we're just going to play New York and New Orleans, and we were making a great living.
Yeah.
And band was doing great in both markets, but record deal, man, we didn't think it was going to happen. And then all of a sudden it just happened like that, you know, you just never know.
And so that guy, Jay Flom, he was a guy, I saw the Twisted Sister documentary. He was the same guy trying to push Twisted, wasn't he? In their documentary.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Which you're in that, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. I'm in the Twisted Sister thing. And, you know, he had heard of Twisted Sister, of course, because once he came out to see Zebra, you know, people were telling him about Twisted. And I suggested that he go see Twisted, you know. And we were playing a show with them up in near Poughkeepsie. Mm. And Jason went up there and he saw how the crowd was with Twisted. And, you know, he went back to Atlantic and said, you know, these guys are happening. This was where our record had already, I think we were already in the studio at this point, you know. But and Twisted had a record out in England, but they were having a little bit of a hard time getting an American deal. And then Jason, you know, got him signed over here.
Yeah.
And since then, Jason's just been signing stuff like blockbusters. I mean, his latest is Greta Van Fleet. So
So you're still in touch with the guy?
Oh, I've been in touch with him all these years, you know. And I mean, he signed Lord and Kid Rock and, you know, I mean, the list is like ridiculous. You know, you look at this guy, he's like, you know, he's really had an unbelievable career in A&R.
So now when he makes a recommendation, he doesn't have to beg people to listen, I guess.
No.
With that record.
No.
Very cool, man. Thank you for sharing that story. That was really awesome. So the album takes off. Did you have any inkling at all like it would be successful? Did the record company say, hey, I think you got something here, be prepared? Or like, what was your mindset all of a sudden, this thing's nuts?
You know, it didn't just go nuts all of a sudden. It was interesting because we did sell those records, you know, right away. It went nuts for those first couple of weeks. And it went nuts because probably we were the biggest bar band ever.
Yeah.
That's what I'm guessing, you know.
Yeah.
We had done so well on the local level, we just sold that many copies right out of the box without anybody else having heard us. And then the sales slowed down, you know, when that first, and I think it leveled off at like about 100,000. And it wasn't, and Atlantic didn't put much money into promotion either. You know, they were just like holding back, and they did give us some tour support. We got a tour with Loverboy, and then St. Louis. They kept trying to get the record played around the country, and a station in St. Louis, KSHE, started playing Who's Behind the Door. It was either Who's Behind the Door or Tell Me What You Want in heavy rotation. Mm. And we got a call one day that says, you sold some records in St. Louis. You know, I said, oh, that's great. How many? You know, I'm expecting them to say tens of thousands. They said, we sold seven. I'm like,
oh, wow. No,
they're serious. You know, they really sold seven or whatever it was, a handful of records. And that to them was great. That meant that the radio airplay was turning into actual sales. They pulled us off the road and we made a video, which they got on MTV. And then that was when they started to really promote the thing.
So they decided to throw some money at it, at you guys.
They wanted to see that it was just the recording itself was going to sell records. I guess that was the philosophy, and that's what they waited for. And that was like three months maybe after the record came out, you know. So it took a while, and I learned a lot during that time about how record companies work and how the industry works. So
yeah, man, if you had known that, you could have gone down there and bought like a dozen and maybe had two or three videos made.
Yeah, well, believe me, people do that all the time, you know. And wow. It does work that way, but at that time we knew nothing, and Casey was a big part of setting that into motion.
That's great. Did you guys have to make, or let's just talk about from you yourself? Here you'd been 7 years busting your butt at this thing. You're young. Did you have to make any kind of adjustments? Because I would imagine all of a sudden, like, you're the next, you know, the next greatest thing since sliced bread. And like, I would imagine you're overwhelmed and you suddenly have a ton of commitments and everybody, you know, what's that expression? A winner has, you know, everybody wanted to be your best friend. You know, was there any adjustments that you had to make?
You know, not really. I mean, I've thought about, you know, this whole fame thing, and we never crossed that threshold where couldn't walk out. I mean, I think about people like Michael Jackson or the Beatles and how they adjusted or didn't adjust to that kind of fame. You know, that's big. You know, with us, it was pretty easy because, you know, we had 7 years to get used to what we already had on this local level. And then once we were out on the road, it wasn't too much different. You know, the only difference with the road was that the road was actually more boring. I mean, the shows were great, playing 20,000 people, which is good, but you're just going from town to town. I think the thing that it taught me was that we were really going to have to get down to work. It wasn't going to be as fun. We weren't going to be partying as much as we were for the past 7 years. I mean, here we were playing like five nights a week, but you know, you finish work and then you go party for the day and sleep a couple hours, get up and do it again, you know?
Right.
With the record deal, we really needed to write, you know, they were expecting another record. So it wasn't all the time for the partying and stuff. And so that had to stop. And that's what we did. But other than that, it was, I think that was the biggest adjustment for us, you know, was, just a bit of a lifestyle change. So,
yeah, that's the number one thing everybody says, that being on the road is like, you know, you think it's really glamorous, but man, it is for 90 minutes. And then you got 22 and a half hours of, you know, twiddling your thumbs or getting on a bus or, you know, whatever. And it's just ridiculous to occupy your time.
Yeah, and I didn't like the bus. Of course, we didn't have like a super luxurious buses, but we had some good times on them. But it was better for us to get out. I think by the third record, we were driving cars. There's only three of us, and let's just get out of here. You know, get to the next town. You know, I think it was less expensive too. So,
right.
I still prefer that. You know.
Yeah.
Been waiting for everybody, you know. You got to wait on the bus for everybody to be ready, whoever it is, and it's just a lot, you know.
Yeah.
Out of here, get to work.
Hey, I want to ask you just a couple of questions about two of my favorite songs, which is Not Surprised, Take Your Fingers From My Hair, and Who's Behind the Door. What was Who's Behind the Door about? Like, is there a backstory to that, or?
Yeah, you know, my biggest influence for that song was the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. And to this day, for me, that's like, you know, untouched as far as, you know, movies go about extraterrestrials and, you know, how we're here or, you know, if there's anybody else out there. And I think that the reason for it is that you never see you know, who the extraterrestrials are. Have you seen the movie?
Ages ago. Tracking very faintly. I mean, quite a while ago.
It's a long, long movie. And the reason it was so long was because the special effects were just so off the charts that they were really trying to, like, you know, show them as much as they were the plot to the movie. And it does drag on. But there's two storylines in it. And one of them is the story with Hal, the computer, you know, and then the other storyline is, of course, the monolith and where are they going and where is it taking them? And so I always felt like that really sparked the mystery in me to write who's behind the door. And it just, you know, made me think about how little we really know.
Yeah.
You know, as far as, you know, religion, science and all of it thrown in. And I think the guys that made the film, they understood that, and that was what they were trying to convey. And it definitely had a big effect on me, you know? And I remember, you know, that, evidently the lyrics had, you know, gotten to some people at NASA too, because they used it on the song on a space shuttle launch.
So did they really?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That must have been great.
Somebody got it. Yeah. That was a big thrill.
That's really, you know what? I never knew that. So I was always thinking, probably like every other person who's behind the door, like, you know, the door in the door here in your room, but you meant like a big door of space and, like, you know, global life.
I'm talking about like God. You know?
Yeah.
I'm talking about who's behind that door.
Yeah.
Know? And it's funny because we tried to get zebra.com as our, you know, website, and it had been taken by a barcode company. And this is going way back. So I said, okay, well, what besides Zebra could we use that people would know? And I said, thedoor.com, you know? Well, it was so long ago, you know, that nobody had taken thedoor.com.
That's great.
And since then, I've been approached by at least 10 or 15, you know, religious groups trying to get that name.
For the same reason.
Yeah, it's a big symbolic, you know, thing,
man,
in a lot of different religions, you know.
Now I've got to go back and re-listen to the song now that I know the real meaning of it. That's so cool. That's great, man. And take your fingers from my hair, 7.5 minutes long. Did you know it'd be that long when you first presented it to the band?
No, not really. We, you know, I had the song and we worked out the arrangement, you know, at rehearsal. And, we never really worried about how long the song was. You know, sometimes we would make them too long and we would edit them ourselves after we'd listened back. But, to me, you know, a song should just determine its own length.
I agree.
And
man, of course,
yeah. And if it's good enough, you know, you want to have all the elements in it, of course, with, radio and record companies, you know, they want the song to be shorter so they can be played. So a lot of times you get shortened versions of songs that don't really live up to the entire song. But Take Your Fingers From My Hair works at 7 minutes. You know, it's got, I don't look back and say, well, we should have cut this or cut that.
No, that's perfect, that song, man. You kidding? No, that's thanks. That's great. I know exactly what you mean. I write ad copy, and it's the same way when you're writing copy. You want to be as economical as possible, but you need to write as much as you need to tell whatever story or sell whatever you're selling. And it's just probably the same thing writing songs is what you're saying.
Yeah.
So I totally get that, man. Is there a backstory to that song?
You know, a lot of people say, oh, you must have had a tough time, you know, tough relationship, but you know, it really wasn't that. I would just look at other friends of mine mainly and write their stories, you know, try to empathize with them. And that was where a lot of these songs came from, you know, One More Chance, Take Your Fingers From My Hair, all the, you know, Love Gone Wrong songs. Yeah. Tell Me What You Want. You know, they were really not so much about me, but about people I knew, you know?
Well, you mentioned it twice that you were married. That was a young age to be married as like a rock star. Are you with the same wife still?
Yes, she's right here.
Dude, how many years is that?
37.
Congratulations, man. Thank you. Awesome. That's the coolest thing you did, more than the music, man, because I've been with my wife 26 and I know it's a journey, man. That's work, you know, in a good way, work.
That's great.
Yeah, man. That's good. Congratulations. That's very cool.
That's, you know, it's really been easy. You know, I found the right woman and she's been, couldn't have asked for more, you know.
Good for you guys, man. Congratulations. What'd she say? What'd she say?
She said, he's only saying that because I'm here.
Yeah, it's big brownie points you're getting, man. Keep it up. That's okay. Hey, how was it playing with Yorma and the Jefferson Airplane? Do you have any cool experiences from that?
Yeah, I mean, that was just really, really a lot of fun. I mean, you know, I was 12 years old, I guess, the first time I heard Jefferson Airplane. And so when I went on the road with them, you know, I guess at that point I figured they were going to be cool people, but we had a great, great time. They had a great sense of humor. Yorma was awesome. And Grace, a lot, big sense of humor. I hung out with Jack Cassidy quite a bit, and you know, they all have their own personalities, but they were at the time, I guess Grace was like 50 at the time, you know? And so they had been through a lot, you know, at this point, you know, in their careers, and everybody was, you know, mature and had grown up. A lot of the stories I had heard about them previously, all that was in the past. And, you know, without getting too crazy, it was that they were just fun to be around. You know, they were very witty, smart people, and a lot of fun to be around. You know, Paul Kantner was a character. I can tell you that. You know, definitely unique. I do remember when we were playing in San Francisco, and we were doing an outdoor show, and I think we had the a couple of guys from the Grateful Dead were opening the show, and Jefferson Airplane was headlining. It was a free show in the park, and there was like 110,000 people at this show.
Holy crap.
Yeah. And we're standing on the side of the stage, you know, while the opener is on, and the police are, you know, guarding the stage and whatever. And one of them goes, okay, and Paul is smoking a joint on the side of the stage. And the policeman goes over to him and says, listen, man, you know, I know you smoke pot and whatever, but, you know, would you mind, you know, a little respect? And Kantner, and, you know, Kantner just looks at him and goes, write me a ticket. You know, just as nasty as, oh, God, I almost wanted to walk away. You know, that was Paul Kantner. You know, that's the way he was, you know, he was throwing right back at him, you know, and the guy just shook his head and walked away back to, you know,
I would have. What year was that?
It's 1989
in San Francisco. That is mind boggling that in 1989 a cop's actually asking somebody to put out a joint, a musician at a concert.
Yeah, well, and he knew bizarre. That, you know, with me, I was kind of like, if it was me and I'd been doing it, I probably would have said, oh, no problem. And I, you know,
yeah, you I would have been this, yeah.
Yeah, I would have put it out or walked away or gone somewhere else, you know, but not Paul. He was going to just do it. You know, the guy wasn't like threatening him. He was just asking him to, because, you know, I guess you have the police there, you have all these people watching him smoke pot, and it's kind of like in your face. And I can understand it from the policeman's point of view, you know,
totally.
It's a little bit rude, but, you know, that's the kind of tour it was. One other thing that was pretty funny with Paul was that, when I first went out to do rehearsals with them, you know, like you said before, Kenny Aronoff had made the suggestion that I come out. And so Kenny and I were, you know, we were both really excited about playing. And when I first went out, they were in the middle of rehearsals, you know, and they hadn't played together in a while, and things were a little bit loose. And so after about a week, you know, it started to sound pretty good. You know, it was starting to sound tight, and I was like, wow, this is getting good, you know? And at the end of the rehearsal on that day, you know, just when it's starting to sound tight, you know, Paul Kantner says, okay, that's it. We're done. You know, see you guys on the road. And Kenny and kind of looking at each other like, wait a minute, this is crazy. You know? We thought he was joking, but everybody all of a sudden just starts acting like what he said. His assistant comes over asking him about flights to get out that night. And do you want this one, that one? And so Kenny and I walked over and said, is this for real? He says, oh yeah. Oh yeah. This is, you know, he says, and Kenny says, but Paul, it's just starting. So we just have another couple of rehearsals. It'll be really, really. Paul goes, yeah, that's the problem. We don't want it to be really, really tight. We want it to be loose. And right now it's almost a little too tight. Says, so we're calling the rehearsal right now. So Kenny and I are looking at each other like, you know, is this for real? We're like thinking he's pulling our leg because there was a lot of teasing and, you know, practical jokes. But sure enough, that was what it was. They didn't want to rehearse anymore. So anyway, we go on the road. We're doing gigs, and every gig things get better. It's getting tighter and tighter, and it's starting to really sound like we envisioned it sounding, you know, with a couple of more rehearsals. And we get to Radio City Music Hall. We're doing two shows there, and at the end of the second show, we're in a, you know, in the car going back to the hotel, and look in the, I think it was the New York Post or the Daily News had done a you know, review of the first night's show, and the guy who wrote the review says it was great seeing the band again on stage, the original members and everything, but unfortunately, the band just sounded too tight and too polished.
Oh my God.
Here it was. I said, man, I said, this is just unbelievable.
Can't,
you know, just
win, man.
No, you can't make it up. You know, he really knows his audience. He knows what makes, it's, you know,
crazy
them enjoy the show. And he was right, you know, and this guy who had written the article had just called it out, you know, too polished. Really funny.
What? You know, Jorm is a really unique player. Having played with him, what about him makes him unique? I know that's like a, I don't know if that's a clear question. What was different about him, his playing, than other people that you've played with?
You know what? I can't really say what it was about his playing that was different, because, you know, his electric playing during the Airplane, you know, the early years was so completely removed from Hot Tuna.
Yeah.
That I don't think that you can see, I don't see a bridge there, you know, for me personally, you know, to where you make that change. You know, it's such a big distance that it's almost as if two different people had, you know, approached an instrument and approached it in their own way. But what I can tell you is that Jorma, really, really smart guy and really open to, you know, new ideas, and wasn't closed minded and kind of, you know, I would have to say always looking to enjoy whatever experience was presented to him. And from that, I think comes a completely different kind of creativity, you know, towards each individual instrument. He didn't look at a guitar as a guitar. It was, you know, an acoustic guitar, or it was an electric guitar using this sound as opposed to, you know, a sound, and his playing would mirror that, you know, and he wanted to get the most out of the acoustic. And I think, you know, he went to different influences to find those when he was doing Hot Tuna and stuff. I mean, I know that sounds vague, but
no, when I asked the question, I knew it really wasn't answerable. So you answered it like the best way you can, you know, I think,
I really look at it as like an intelligence thing and an open-mindedness thing, you know, and I really found him to be, yeah, that was the way he was. He had a great sense of humor, you know, has a great sense of humor and, you know, just a great player.
When you play, one of the things you just said that I think is a skill set about him, you said that he really likes to enjoy himself while he's playing. Are you able to do that? Or do you like focus on the, you do. That's great.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of times I have a hard time keeping my eyes open when I play, because I tend to play better when my eyes are shut because I'm more focused, but I know that I'm performing. So I have to almost force myself to open my eyes and engage the audience because I'm so into that, especially when I'm doing like an acoustic, thing. I enjoy it. It's kind of like therapy,
That's great. What's that? What's that?
It's not going to ring.
Bell's not going to ring. Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. It's interesting because when you see, I'll tell you afterwards who it was, but I saw a concert 2 weeks ago and, it was so disappointing because it was a few different bands. And one of the guys who I really loved his playing, he just was not even there, man. It was just like, he did the opposite. He didn't close his eyes. He didn't open his eyes. He was just like, I know you've played the songs 1,000 times. I totally get it. But man, you can't have that attitude like, oh, I've just done this 1,000 times.
You could have been having a bad day. And yeah. I've had bad days. I've had bad days where I didn't want to be up there and that no amount of music was going to change that, or where I have been, you have a personal issue or something's going on that you can't shake before you go on stage. So, but I'd say for me, that's a 0.0001% of the time. A lot of people drag everything on stage with them, and that's not a good thing. You really need to leave it behind.
Well, then, and I don't want to get all in this. And then the lead singer he's throwing cables. He was pissed off at something. So the whole thing was like, wow, it was just a little kind of a weird. I hadn't seen any shows like that.
That day, maybe they were nuts, or maybe they had a bad sound check, or things just weren't going right. But you can't bring that on stage. I mean, if there's a technical issue on stage, with me, you've got to just go with it and laugh about it because people didn't come there to see you and to complain.
Yeah.
They're there to get away from the complaining of their own jobs, and they're there to enjoy it. So if you can make light of any issues you're having, we're all human. You that's the only way you can do it. You don't have to be perfect all the time.
Yeah.
And people, they kind of like to see that your things can happen, and they like to see the way you handle it if you handle it the right way. They didn't come there to see a train wreck,
Yeah. And it's funny, when I see someone closing their eyes, a player, I'm like, I'm pumped because I know that guy's in a zone and he's given me 100 or she's given me 110%. So it's, I like that. I like, when you're into it, man, it makes me feel like I'm getting great stuff, from the heart stuff, which is why you come to a show, as you know.
Yeah. Well, that's focus, total focus,
Hey, where in Louisiana are you originally from?
New Orleans.
What was
up in New Orleans.
What was your childhood like?
Lakefront. My parents were both attorneys, and they were very open to the music thing from the get-go. They took my brother and I to see the Beatles in 1964. That was my first concert, and they used to play Les Paul and Mary Ford records for us before that. And, they bought us – I had a drum kit. My father was a drummer too. We bought a little drum kit for – I think I played the drums first, and my brother played guitar. And, they were very supportive the whole time. Had a lot of friends that played music in elementary school and had some bands. And I loved sports. I played a lot of football, loved football. But in high school, I had to stop all the contact sports because found out I had a missing lock on my vertebrae.
Oh, wow.
Between L4 and L5, it's called spondylolisthesis, I think it's called. And there were like three different doctors with three different opinions as to what to do. One of them wanted to fuse it. One of them wanted to don't do anything and go ahead and play your contact sports. Football players do this all the time. Third guy said, quit the contact sports because you can certainly injure yourself and your back's going to be in a bad shape. So we chose to just do no more contact sports. Yeah. I was at in high school, and maybe that had me focus more on the music at that point.
Yeah, because that L5, man, that's the place you always injure. Always gets injured, man, on anybody that's doing anything athletic. So yeah, that was
It was a congenital thing. I was just missing the locks. something, it was just, they weren't there. My vertebrae were just floating on top of each other at that point, you know? So, but wow. I had a little bit of problem with it about 20 years later because I was lifting too much stuff, but in general, it's been okay.
That's great. Good, man. It's interesting. That's another, you know, one of the, again, having interviewed so many people, that one of the very prevalent characteristics of the most successful and the most talented players is they had tremendous support from parents. It's really very, even if the home life wasn't good and the parents, you know, had issues, they had support for their music for the parents. Which is really cool. And I think that's really cool that both your folks were attorneys and they were both real supportive of that. Cause you don't always have stuff like that, as you know.
Yeah, no, my parents were great. And, you know, they both played me. My mom played piano, you know, when she was younger, and my dad was a drummer. So they both had music in their backgrounds, and that was, you know, couldn't ask for better. And then they were both helped out along the way as far as, you know, once we started doing the record deal and all that kind of stuff, you know, it was very helpful to have a couple of attorneys there. You know?
Yeah, I bet. That's great, man. What have been some of the bigger obstacles that you've had to deal with along the way, either like musically or personally or business related, stuff you had to like really dig deep to overcome, if you had stuff like that?
You know, I think the biggest hiccup for me was the China Rain record when I did the solo record for Atlantic. Atlantic had come back to me after they had released Zebra. They came back a couple of years later, same two guys, Jason Blum and Doug Morris, and wanted me to do a solo record. And they didn't want it to be another Zebra record. And so I said, okay, I'll give this a shot. We'll see what happens. So I spent just about 2 years making this record. I went out and wrote with a lot of different people. It wasn't going to be a Zebra record. It was going to be, you know, more of an 80s style music record, you know, and I was going to put another band together, which I did. And Atlantic spent a lot of money to do this, and the record sounded great. You know, songs were awesome. I'd probably written like 30 or 40 songs with other people, you know, for the record, which we ended up with 10. And then right before the release date, I get a call from Jason Blum, and he says they've decided they're not going to release the record. Mm. And it took me a while to figure out what the deal was. But, you know, it really had to do with money. I mean, that was the while I was making that record was when Nirvana had come out. And Atlantic was one of the last record labels to get on the grunge train, you know, and they had kind of fallen behind. And so my record being new from a quote unquote, like, you know, untested, that was gone. They dropped a couple of other bands in the process too. They kept bands like Skid Row and that were still on the label that were doing well. But that period was kind of over at that point when the grunge thing came out. So it couched me for a while. But I remember that summer, I was like, you know, still questioning, well, maybe it was, you know, maybe it was something else. What did, you know, did I say something wrong or blah, blah, blah. You know, you always have these questions.
Yeah, of course.
I remember that was the summer where all of a sudden they started to promote the Led Zeppelin box set. You remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
Led Zeppelin, greatest hits catalog and all this stuff, right? Late night TV, you couldn't like turn the station without seeing one of these ads. And it was unique because Led Zeppelin had refused to do any sort of greatest hits package for Atlantic up until that time. So Atlantic must have went to them and made an incredible deal, you know, for them to have released that. And it was at that time because they were in the red for two quarters. Atlantic had been in the red for two quarters while, you know, right leading up to them not releasing my record. So I could see that they were having financial issues, and for Led Zeppelin to have done that, they must have really needed to do, you know.
That was the one with how the West was won, that one?
No, this is before that.
Yeah, I don't remember that one.
Yeah, this is, well, it's the first time that Led Zeppelin had released any sort of greatest hits package. And it was the big, big box. Remember the big box? It was like the size of an album, and they had the four CDs in it. And
Okay. Yes.
That was the first time they had ever repackaged any Led Zeppelin stuff officially, you know? That was 1989, 1990, you know?
And so was it weird that they approached you to do a side project when you have this successful band? Or is that?
Well, it was weird. It was only weird that they didn't want to do it with the band again. You know, I thought we could still do another Zebra record, but they just didn't want to do it for some reason. It was, and so I went in and I did that, and it was a little odd. Yeah. But you know, the whole thing's been a little odd, but the big bump for me was that I had spent 2 years of my life doing this, and now I've got nothing.
Yeah.
And what I'm going to do from here, and it kind of put me on a couch for about 2 weeks, you know, just laying there thinking what to do. And I finally got up and I put together a solo show, which I called the MIDI show. So I had a Macintosh computer, you know, and I sequenced a bunch of, you know, the Zebra stuff and some of my solo stuff and some covers, some Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and Moody Blues, and put a show together. It took me a year to do it, but it was all, I had the lights programmed, I had the mixing programmed, and it was going to be a completely automated show that I ran with my feet as I went. And it was really impressive, you know, but it was great therapy for me.
Yeah.
So that's what I did for the following year. And that led to some other things. That led to me doing some work for a company that was doing an interactive musical instrument called Pete. And they hired me, and we did that for about 3 or 4 years. And I learned a lot. And, you know, getting back to the original question, that was probably the biggest bump. But out of it came, you know, a lot of knowledge. And it was good.
Were the guys, and you don't have to answer this because I'm not asking you to make you uncomfortable. Were the guys was Felix and Guy, were they like weird about it when, like, you know, which would have been normal?
Yeah, I know Felix didn't like it at all. And, you know, when I told him that they didn't want it to be a Zebra record, I think he kind of half believed me for some reason. But, you know, I definitely put the question to Atlantic about that, you know, but Felix and I had a conversation, you know, years earlier, even before Zebra, when Felix and I were in a band, his band, called Shepherd's Bush before Zebra, and it was all originals that he had written, you know. And we always remembered a story of a guy in New Orleans, older band, and this one guy in the band was offered a gig to be a solo artist and go to Vegas and become like the next Engelbert Humperdinck, you know, back in the 60s.
Yeah.
And he refused to leave his band to do it. And so Felix and I would talk about that, you know, and this is before Zebra, that, you know, he blew his shot. So that always entered my mind, you know, that somewhere he had to understand that if that was what they were offering me, I needed to go there. Now, I never said we were breaking Zebra up or anything. As a matter of fact, we continued performing Zebra, you know, the whole time. We've never had any time where we quote unquote broke up. That was never the intention. But yeah, I'm sure, you know, and I'm sure Guy didn't think it was such a great thing either, you know, but you know.
Yeah. It's just
been a couple of years since the last record, you know, and I was okay, let's go. This is what it is, you know?
Yeah. It's one of those things where if it happens to you, versus if it happens to the other guy, your reaction's totally different, you know. And it's just it's just one of those things, man. You know, there's nothing. It's going to be awkward no matter who it happens to. It's just what vantage point you're looking at it, how weird it is, or you know, yeah. It's just totally get it. Well, man, that's tough.
It was never a deal breaker or a friendship breaker between us, you know, ever.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. What if you could, is there any advice you would have liked to receive? Like if you could have given yourself advice, you know, the young Randy Jackson advice, what would have helped you, assuming you'd have been open to it?
I think maybe, you know, to write more songs, you know, just spend more time writing when I was younger, you know, and I did write a lot of stuff. I did spend a lot of time doing that, but, you know, I could have always written more. You know, you look at McCartney and Lennon, and it seems like everything they wrote eventually got put out. You know, they were just hit makers, you know, but for somebody like me, you know, I'd have to write like 3 or 4 songs before I'd find one that was, you know, I thought suitable to,
sure,
to perform, you know? And so from quantity is going to come the quality for me. Right. And so I think I would have advised myself to just have written more, you know, and be more, a little more prepared for the first Zebra record, you know, because when it came to the second record, we were like, I wrote one song for the second Zebra record, you know, at the time, but the rest of them were just either songs we didn't use on the first record or just going back and revisiting a bunch of stuff that either we hadn't done at all or old tapes that I had, you know. Mm. And so that was a big learning experience too.
Sure.
Whereas the third record, you know, was pretty much written from scratch, you know, between the second and third. And I think that was the record I was the most proud of, you know, the third record, because I really did. But I wish I would have written more and have been more ready for the second record, I think.
Yeah. Is that what, now that you're saying this, is that, you know, they always talk about the sophomore slump. Is that probably one of the reasons why? Because all of a sudden now you got to write and holy shit, and you got to make this record real quick. We got to get it out.
Well, it could be, you know, and in our case, you know, we were playing gigs,
yeah,
all the time, and we were writing songs, but it was like, you know, maybe 2-3 songs, 4 songs a year we were adding, you know, original songs to the set list. And, you know, that's not enough. You, yeah, know, you got to really, you know, at that point. So when you get that first record deal, you can't all of a sudden just say, okay, we're going to, you know, you should have too many songs. That should be the problem, you know.
Yeah. Yeah,
and we probably just didn't have enough good stuff, you know. I mean, not that I don't, that I dislike the second record, and some people say it's their favorite record, but I think, you know, as a record, it's not an album of songs that are, that sound like they should be on the same record. I mean, you can listen to it, and it like goes to so many different places. There's, it's not as cohesive as the first or the third or even the fourth record, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Musically, in my mind, you know?
I never thought of that when you just said, you know, McCartney. Has anybody ever looked like how many songs they wrote? Because maybe their ratios are no different than anybody else's. Or are they?
There's so many books, you know, written, and there's so much that I just don't know. I you know, pretty much it sounds to me like everything they've done was recorded. Not when I say everything, I mean, you know,
yeah,
not every single little, yeah, thing, but, you know, you can really kind of tell in, like Abbey Road, for instance, mm, right? You've got that whole medley on the backside of Abbey Road. And
yeah,
a lot of those songs are like 30 seconds, a minute,
like Her Majesty, you know, or something.
Pieces. Well, not even Her Majesty, even before that. Her Majesty's definitely like a little vignette in its own, but you've got, you know, Polythene Pam, and you've got, you know, what was right before that? Me, Mr. Mustard. They're just short little things that just connect to each other, you know, and they're not whole songs.
Right.
And would they have worked as whole songs? Probably not, but they were just pieces of stuff. So, you know, it seems like they were just, and they're great in their own right, you know. It's not like they're junk, you know. The thing with the Beatles was that you can go back and listen, and there's very, very few songs that I listen to and go, oh, God, you know, why did they ever do this, you know?
Yeah.
They went off, but, man, the stuff, it just holds up even till today. It's just, like, unbelievable. It was, yeah, it was just the quality of everything that they did, you know?
Sure.
And how could you write? I mean, the thing is that if I had to write all those records, you know, you know, and come up with that. I know how many songs I would have to write to come up with that quality for that many records.
Right.
And there's not enough time in your lifetime.
But, for me,
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know, this is just prolific, incredible songwriting. You know?
But you do realize you are, your benchmark here is like the two greatest songwriters in the history of ever music. Yeah. Like if you pick something between that and like, you know, 80% of that, that's probably like, you know, right where you're at, you know, which is the norm for like good songwriters like you.
Yeah. But you know, like it just, you know, it still boggles my mind.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how great you say they are, no matter how good, you know, this, that, and the other, to me, it's like just, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, it's really unbelievable. And I appreciate it as a songwriter, you know, and I think a lot of people just, you know, they say, oh yeah, they were the great, great songwriters and stuff. But when you've done it and you've been in the trenches writing songs and you know what it takes to, you know, to connect parts and make them work together, then your appreciation for what they did in that short time is just, you know, it just grows exponentially. You're just like amazed.
Yeah. And I've never looked at them that way. And this is the first time I've heard that. And you're right. It is incredible. It is pretty incredible. I mean, it's almost impossible, actually. Wow.
Yeah. It's bizarre.
Hey, let's talk about gear for a minute. You had like tons of different guitars. And so like, what were your top three guitars back then? And like, what are your top three now that you're playing? Talking about electrics, or no, you can talk about acoustics, whatever you want.
I mean, I play the acoustic a lot. I mean, what I'm playing right now is a Michael Kelly 12-string acoustic. It's a prototype, but
he's right down here, man.
Sounds great.
He's right down here, Michael Kelly. He's in St. Pete. Yeah, I'm in Tampa. I interviewed. I forgot his name. Shit. Why am I having a brain fart here? Michael Kelly is the name of his kids. That's how he came up with the name of the company.
That's right. That's right.
He's a really cool guy. I can't believe it. Anyway, I'm having a senior moment. But yeah, they're right down here. So he made you a 12-string model.
It's a 12-string cutaway, and it's the Michael Kelly acoustic guitars, they don't have a hole over the strings. The holes are all like on the side of the guitar and in different places. So it you don't have as much problem with the feedback or having to put one of those stops in it. And the thing just stays in tune great. And I've gotten so many compliments since I started playing it about the tone of the guitar. People have really loved it. So
that's cool, man.
That's been a good one. You know, I still have my VC Riches, you know, from back in the day. The one that I loved the most was the Mockingbird Supreme, and it got stolen and never did replace that.
But I just
recently acquired a Bunker guitar. Have you ever heard of a Bunker?
No, where are they out of?
Well, Dave Bunker is the guy who made the guitar, and it was back in the 60s, actually.
Oh, wow.
And so when you look at it, you think it looks like a BC Rich. And BC Rich's factory was actually just a couple of miles away from where he was. You know how the wood, he'd have the three different types of wood, you know, colors and stuff together for the BC Rich. Well, this was his guitar, the Bunker guitar. He was doing this before then.
Wow.
And
how'd you get turned on to this? How'd you find out about this?
Well, he did some things over the years. He had a thing called the touch guitar, and I had heard about that, you know, and it's a guitar. You play a bass and a lead with your right hand, bass with your left hand, two necks, you know, kind of a touch tapping guitar, but it's not tapping. It's a whole different technique. And he invented that. He's got the patent on that, but you should check him out. Dave Bunker. He's a real interesting character, and he made these great Bunker guitars back then. And I acquired one of them recently and, got it all fixed up. And,
tell me about your Les Paul with the one pickup missing, man. What was the deal with that? You had this like beautiful black beauty, but the top pickup, was gone.
That happened during the second Zebra record. We were trying different pickups in the guitar to get a different tone on the guitar. So we were taking pickups out, just slapping them in, and you know, whether it was the treble pickup or the rhythm pickup. And at the end of the day, the treble pickup that we put in sounded great. We hadn't put back in the rhythm pickup, and I just left it out, you know, just from laziness. That's all it was, you know. So I think it still doesn't even have the rhythm pair. I still have the guitar.
You still have the guitar? Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, it's a great sounding guitar, but you know, it's a little too heavy.
Oh, those old Les Pauls were ridiculous, man.
They're really heavy. Yeah, like boat anchors. But it was a great guitar.
That's wild. I was always curious, like, what the hell, what was going on there? Anybody that influenced your playing that people would be surprised to hear?
Maybe the Allman Brothers, you know. I'm a big Allman Brothers fan. I don't know if they'd be that surprised, but, you know, like, it's certainly like a different genre, you know.
Dickie or Dwayne? Both. Or both, yeah.
Both, yeah. You know, I was a big Allman Brothers fan. And, yeah, great stuff. I learned a lot of the Allman Brothers stuff in memory of Elizabeth Reed, note for note, you know, when I was a kid, you know.
Beautiful song.
And, Grand Funk. I used to listen to a lot of Grand Funk, you know. And I learned a lot from listening to that.
We're one of the coolest bands around for sure, man.
Yeah, they were. Yeah. They were awesome, you know. Yeah. At one point, they were like the biggest thing going, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, and of course I mentioned Les Paul earlier. That was a big influence on me, you know.
Were you a jazz guy when you were younger?
No, it was more about the feel, you know, for me. It wasn't about the playing. That was like the first record I ever had when I was a kid, before the Beatles. My parents had it, actually. They didn't buy it from me, but I was just drawn to it. My brother and I would just want that record on, and we would run around the house to that music, Hold That Tiger, How High the Moon and stuff, and it just got the juices going. So I think that was my first experience with music really turning your emotions, you know, changing them and, you know, getting you to this, you know, ecstatic state, you know, other than cartoons at the time.
Yeah. Which some of those old cartoons had great, like those old Bugs Bunny. I tell my kids that and they're like, Dad, come on. They don't realize the sound, you know, the soundtracks and like Bugs Bunny was like, it's phenomenal stuff, you know. You tell that to people, they laugh at you, but it was...
The theme song to the Jetsons was a great, you know, I mean, you listen to the orchestration and it's just like, it's great stuff, you know.
Right, yeah.
But when it came to like, you know, a band or, you know, just musicians, it was, the first one was really Les Paul, you know, so.
Very cool, man. Desert Island Discs. Tough question. Desert Island Discs. Yeah. Top three, no order. And just for today, you know, like tomorrow you could change them. So like, what's your knee jerk reaction?
Led Zeppelin 4. Meet the Beatles. And Dark Side of the Moon.
That's my number one, man. You know what? Did you ever see that documentary? It's about the making of Dark Side of the Moon.
No.
It's on Netflix. It'd be worth your time. And Roger Waters was talking about it, and he was talking about, you know, where they made it, and The Lunatic Is on the Grass he was talking about. And apparently they all went to Cambridge University, and they were so ridiculous in their mind because there's this quaint patch of grass, which, you know, you want to walk on it and enjoy it. And there's these signs, do not step on the grass.
Do not step on the grass, yeah.
So check this out. So my wife is from the UK. So we went, gosh, 90, I don't know, six. No, it's later. There's probably, 2000 maybe. And we went there, and my son's into the same kind of music I am, my older one. He's 28. But so we went there, and we went to Cambridge. And I said, man, I got to find this freaking patch of grass. So, and I did some research, and it was in King's College Chapel was the name of the building. So we went there, man, and it had to be before that. And I found it, and sure enough, they had the same signs there. Do not.
Really?
Yeah. And so we sat on a bench with, I don't think it was an iPod. I think I had, you know, like a CD player. But I had the headphones with two sets so we could both listen to it. And it was the coolest thing. Like, one of the best memories I have as a dad, we sat there listening to Dark Side of the Moon, specifically that track. Yeah, watching The Patch of Grass. Because that's where the freaking guy sat and wrote the song. So I was like, oh my God, this is so nutty. You know?
Yeah.
Very. But check that movie out.
It's a great story.
Yeah, he has some good stuff in there. Roger Waters in particular. He says some stuff that I thought was pretty smart and intelligent.
I read something about Dark Side of the Moon the other day where he had brought in Paul and Linda McCartney to do voices.
Really? I didn't know. That's
You know, the part where they're talking on the record.
Yeah.
Where the guys are talking. And so it was interesting because he said the way they did it was he would ask a question.
Yeah. Yes. Index cards.
Answers, and he brought them in to answer the questions, but ended up not using anything they said because their answers were not interesting enough. It didn't sound like what he was looking for. They were too, maybe he, I forget what the article actually said, but my memory is politically correct, and he was not looking for that. So they ended up using, you know, somebody who worked around the place, you know, when he interviewed him, you know, with the heavy, you know, British accent, and using his answer. And that's what you hear.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
I'll tell you the one thing he said in there, and when I saw the movie, it made a big impact. I was like ready. It was like one of those things in life where you're like, man, I really needed to hear that, and I was able to make changes in my life. He said, you know, we often go through life saying, as soon as this happens, I'll do this. And when that happens, I'll be able to do that. And he said, I realized a long time ago that life starts at dot and then it's going, man. And there's no do-overs.
No. You gotta go with the flow or fight the flow either way, you know, and you don't know where you're going to end up, you know, but, I understand that completely. You know, you can't, I never try to plan too far ahead. People ask me, where are you playing in 3 weeks? You know, I'd go, not necessary. Right? I know
we're playing tomorrow. Yeah. I was like really ready. And what that did for me is it said, okay, I have to start like being more in the present for sure. And just focusing more on happiness, you know, not happiness at others' expense, but like, that's what it's about. You know, I don't get any do-overs, and I guess I'm 54 now. It's probably, I don't know, 40, young 40s when I heard it. I was ready for that message, and it really made a change because I made changes in my life over the next few years after that. So it was really like almost started me on that journey of making some changes along those lines. So it was pretty cool. So that movie's like, you know, it's nostalgic to me for that reason.
I'll have to watch it. It's going to be in my book of things.
Most important thing you've learned about yourself, man, throughout this whole journey you've been on.
Most important thing I've learned about myself?
Yeah, through this whole journey.
I think I like people. I've learned that I really, you know, and that I enjoy engaging people, you know, in, you know, how can I put it, in civil, you know, conversations that we might disagree on, you know, and I enjoy it because I think I'm traveled enough to see that people are, you know, there are different people in this world, of course, but everybody has pretty much the same goals, and they try to get there in similar ways, you know. And I think that for me, what was it, your original question again? Because I think I'm answering it.
Yeah, it was, what have you learned about yourself throughout this journey?
Yeah. That I can relate to a lot of people, you know, and that I don't have a problem, you know, engaging anyone, you know. There's no fear. I don't have, you know, I think my parents raised me in a good way to not prejudge people, and you know, and I, you know, I guess genetically am more inclined to not be that way, to not have a prejudge disposition, you know, any fear of going to the unknown. I'm not going to be stupid, but, you know, we travel around the world, my wife and I, and we've done some pretty, you know, let's say dangerous things meeting people along the way, you know, but none of them have turned out to be the wrong decision. And maybe that was just blind luck, but it's been interesting, you know, and I think that a lot of people could learn a lot by just going out and exploring a little more. If you haven't been out of the country before, go, you know, and if you do go, don't just go to the places where they're telling you, you know, don't be scared.
Don't look at Yelp, you know? And then follow only the Yelp reviews.
I mean, a lot of times, you know, there's a lot of political reasons that people will put, you know, the Yelp review in there and stuff, but, you know, go with your intuition, you know, don't prejudge and, you know, use your head, try to just be smart, you know.
Is there a story you could share that's not like too personal that you're comfortable sharing and as an example of that? Cause it sounds kind of interesting.
Yeah, we, you know, my wife and I were on vacation down in, where was it? St. Thomas? British Virgin Islands, and we were just walking along the dock. We were looking for a ferry to go to. Where were we going, Felicia? She could tell. She should tell.
Where are you going?
And we were walking along the dock, and we asked this guy, you know, if he knew where we could go to get the ferry. And he was on this boat. And then he says, "Hey, have you ever been on a yacht before?" You know, and we looked and said, "Well, that looks like a pretty nice one, you know?" And he says, "Come on, I'll show you." So we went on the boat and, beautiful, I mean, like, you know, ridiculous, like ridiculous.
Lifestyles of the rich and famous, ridiculous.
Even beyond, it was crazy. Wow. It was crazy. And so we, you know, we went on the boat and we're talking to him, and there's a picture of Noah. Wow. And he goes, "Oh yeah, that's my house in France," you know, and my antenna go up right then, you know, this is like, you know, nah, can't be, this looks like, I mean, it looks like he's got a moat, you know, in part of this thing, you know. Anyway, he says he's there by himself, you know, because he's trying to sell the boat and his, and he's going to be down for a couple of days. And then he says, y'all should come out. You know, we're going to go out for a couple of days on the boat, you know, and it's my wife's birthday. And so, we don't know this guy from Adam, you know, right. But, we go back to our hotel and I'm thinking about it. Wow, this, you know, it's kind of too nice to be true. You know, he doesn't know who we are. You know, he doesn't know Brandy or Zebra or anything like that. Nothing like that. So it's just like we're a couple of people off the dock. And, I knew enough about him. I made a couple of phone calls to friends of mine, but things he had said, and they seemed to check out. So we decided we'd go on the trip, and we ended up going for how many days? Two days, 3 days?
3 days.
3 days we were out on this boat, you know, just cruising on the islands, you know, and it was just, it was bizarre, you know, but that was, you know, I mean, this was one of the, you know, I definitely was thinking, you know, this might be like a warning, but, you know, we went with it and it was great. And he ended up being, you know, a great friend, his family and everything. And
we did go to France.
And we went to France to see the castle. Yeah, we stayed at the castle for a week.
What was his deal? How did he get a castle? Was he like family or like?
No.
Was it Sergey Brin, the founder of Google?
Hard-working guy from New Jersey. He had, did stuff for construction for Johnson & Johnson, had all these contracts, had a huge, huge company. Him and his wife had bought this, they call it a chateau, they don't call it a castle, but it's a castle. And they had bought this thing, and she does weddings out of it, you know, and it just turned out to be, you know, the real, everything that he said, you know.
Would you have gone if you couldn't have checked him out?
Huh?
Would you have still done that if you hadn't been able to make those phone calls and check them out?
My wife probably. My wife wouldn't have gone.
Yeah.
She would have been afraid. She was afraid this was going to be like, what was the name of the movie? Dead Calm. Yeah.
I saw that movie when they're killed out on the boat or something like that. Yeah.
But this guy and his family are awesome, and I'm just glad he made the, he made the invitation. You know, we've been great friends ever since.
That's cool, man. Yeah, I'm from the Bronx. I don't think I would have gone on that. My antenna would have been like, boop, boop, boop. This is wrong. Hey, man, I'm going to ask you two more questions. I really appreciate your time, and I can't thank you enough. You have any hobbies or interests outside of music?
Physics.
Physics?
Yeah.
Wow, that's...
I was, you know, when I was in school, that was my original intention was in college. You know, I had... I was either going to do music or physics. And so after, you know, the band started playing and I left college, and but I still am just intrigued by physics. And I, you know, I follow what I can as to what's going on the cutting edge of it and everything. And it's just getting, you know, these days it's getting weirder and weirder and weirder all the time. So I enjoy it. It's, you know, every day I poke my nose around to see what's going on, you know, and I subscribe to a lot of newsletters and stuff like that. And, you know, it's always fascinating, but I think that had a lot to do also with who's behind the door.
That's exactly what I was thinking, man. Now the dime dropped. I totally get it. Okay. Now that you said that, I totally understand the enthusiasm and what your perspective. Hey, here's a funny story. I interviewed a guy yesterday named John Knowles. John was, he played with Chet Atkins. Chet Atkins nominated like three or four people, and he as what he called CGP, Certified Guitar Players. This guy, John, was the first one. John was a physicist working at Texas Instruments in Houston. He was like 2 or 3 years into his job, and he was a guitar player, and he said, man, I can't do this. I need to go play guitar. And he's much older cat than both of us. You know, he's... you know, mid 70s, maybe later. And so you can only imagine the brushback, like from, you know, pop culture back then and whatever the, you know, early 60s, you're leaving to go play guitar. You're leaving your job as a physicist with Texas Instruments to go give, he went to go give guitar lessons. That was his start of his journey, you know? And that's so funny that, and then you're literally, this was yesterday. It's too weird.
Yeah. Man. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Hey, man. Certified guitar player Chet Atkins was phenomenal.
He had really good guy. Hey, last question, man, and I could actually talk to you forever, but I know you got to get going. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of this change has been deliberate and intentional, and how much has been a natural part of aging?
I think, you know, in the last 10 years, I think I've suffered from depression my whole life. And in the last 10 years, I think I've gotten a much better handle on how to deal with it, you know, through different medications and lifestyle. And I'm feeling much better now than I did, than I have for, you know, I'd say the last 30 or 40 years, you know.
That's great.
Overall, you know. And so that's, for me, been the big change, you know. And so obviously it's been, you know, a trial and error, you know, with different medications, going to see the doctor. But the first step of just going to the doctor was the toughest one for me, and that was over 20 years ago. Yeah. I remember going to the parking lot and saying, I'm about to go, and I can do this. I don't need this, you know.
Yeah.
But when I went, I had stopped drinking and drugs and everything. I hadn't done anything for 10 years. So there was nothing in my system and I was still depressed, you know, but now I can look back and see that I was suffering from that from childhood, you know,
interesting,
and trying to probably self-medicate, you know, in high school with alcohol and stuff. And, but now I've got a good handle on it and I'm feeling great, you know? So I think that's the biggest change for me in the last 10 years. Yeah.
Man, I'm really happy for you, and I appreciate you sharing that. And for whatever it's worth, to me, you're a fucking bright ray of sunshine, man. You've been awesome. So, yeah, man, totally cool. Let me tell people where they could find you, and thank you again. This has been very cool. Okay, so check out, first of all, go back and listen to Zebra Albums. They're a fantastic band, and literally they were the only thing people were listening to back in the day. And you can look up Randy Jackson online, but let me tell you where you can find him. First of all, go to thedoor.com, just thedoor.com. He's also on Twitter at Randy_Zebra. He's on Instagram at RandyJackson22. He's on Facebook. They have three accounts because they're three times cooler than most people. It's Randy Jackson Zebra, Zebra Rock Band, and Randy Jackson of Zebra on Facebook. Again, I'll give you those again. It's on Facebook, Randy Jackson Zebra. And you can probably go on your Facebook account and find all your other social media accounts if you go to About, I would imagine.
Yeah, there's ways to get there. Yeah, if you type in Randy Jackson Zebra in a search on Facebook, you'll probably come up with all of them, you know?
Awesome. Man, thank you very much. And I know you're touring now, too. Zebra's out touring, playing shows.
Yeah, we're playing more than we have in 30 years, probably. You know, we're doing the Florida real soon. We're actually going to be doing a symphony show with the Acadiana Symphony in Lafayette, Louisiana in November. It'll be the first time we're doing that, so I'm looking forward to hearing the Zebra songs with the real strings and stuff on stage. That's going to be really exciting. We're doing a West Coast tour in December, and we're all over the place, you know, so.
Tour dates are on thedoor.com?
Yep. Go to thedoor.com and all the dates are there.
Great.
It's in everything.
Everybody go check out thedoor.com. Go see Zebra. Go tell Randy you heard his interview and that you enjoyed it. Hey, man, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Hang on and we'll wrap up. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, share it with a friend on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Thanks again to Randy Jackson for spending time with us. Still, like, freaks me out. Like, I remember buying the Zebra probably down at Tower Records on East Broadway. So hear him on the phone, on the conversation. Very, very weird. It only happened with one other. Like, I've talked to tons of people, but I guess because your music is very ingrained in my DNA. Another guy that happened with was Dave Mason.
Oh.
Yeah. I interviewed Dave Mason. Same thing. Everybody, go to the homepage, everyoneloesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list. You get advance notice, and you can send some questions into guests I'm interviewing. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.